Your Honor, I've signed in.
Okay.
Kyle Lockwood, Your Honor, from Mr.
All right, and you're going to be arguing on behalf of the...
Definitely.
Okay.
Mr. Sylvester, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
Yes, sir.
And Mr. Pretty, we'll be glad to hear from you when you're ready, then.
It's pretty, you seem to have gotten the memo for this case that we're all to wear bow ties.
Yeah.
Well, it's always nice to come to court appropriately attired. It pleases the court.
I didn't get the memo.
I'm not going to touch that one.
I didn't get the memo.
May it please the court, my name is Vernon Pretty. I'm here today on behalf of Associated Aluminum Products in this workers' compensation claim. The core of this case, I would say, to suggest, Your Honor, is that it's an issue of where a gentleman by the name of Mr. Blair, who was, without dispute, Mr. Elvira Menez's direct employer, where he stands in a pecking order of subcontractors.
So you're arguing now the statutory employer issue?
Yes, sir. I found to start with that because I think that's at one level probably the more interesting one. And what we would submit is that there is really no debate that Associated Aluminum Products would not let Mr. Blair work as a subcontractor to them directly because he did not have workers' compensation insurance. He had lost it some years before, and so he was told that he would have to work for a fellow who also worked occasionally or frequently with Associated Aluminum Products as a subcontractor, Mr. Jenkins. And so that arrangement was made and it was determined to be acceptable to Mr. Jenkins and Mr. Blair.
It seems, counsel, that the test under 65.2-302A is that for this statutory employer-employee relationship to exist, the work must, one, be part of the owner-contractor's trade, business, or occupation, and two, the owner-contractor must have contracted with another to have work performed. Where would you contend that these two elements of the plain language of 65.2302 have not been met?
Well, they were met. Where they were met, though, was at the meeting of Mr. Jenkins and Mr. Blair. And Mr. Jenkins had workers' compensation insurance. Mr. Jenkins was part of his trade, business, and occupation to do the work that Associated Aluminum Products, which was installing aluminum siding or guttering. So you have Jenkins and Associated Aluminum Products really without debate being in the same trade, business, or
occupation. But just to follow up on Judge Alston's question, if I understand the record here in the light most favorable of the party that prevailed below, the company dealt with Blair regarding this roofing job, and there was testimony from the claimant that Blair was the supervisor, correct?
From the claimant,
from
his point of view, Mr. Blair was his supervisor. Yes, sir.
Well, I mean, isn't that evidence that supports the commission's conclusion with regard to the analysis that you're discussing with Judge Alston?
Well, it seems to me, Your Honor, that what it establishes is that Mr. Blair was the direct employer of Mr. Elvira Menez. There's no doubt about that. And so that And there's no doubt that, that Mr. Blair was involved in roofing, which was something that occasionally, even the evidence establishes that Mr. Jenkins did. He didn't do it frequently.
Maybe I'm oversimplifying this, but it seems to me it comes, your point comes down to, does the evidence support the commission's conclusion that the claimant is working for Blair? Or does the evidence support necessarily support a different conclusion that the claimant was working for Jenkins, which is a position you're taking?
Well, at least as I understand, really what we are saying is that Mr. Jenkins was an independent subcontractor to Associated Aluminum, and Blair was an independent contractor who was working under Mr. Jenkins for purposes of workers' compensation. And so, in essence, it's a three-prong. It's not whether Mr. Manette, don't do particularly well with his name either, with the claimant. Whether the claimant was the employee of Mr. Blair or the employee of Mr. Jenkins. In our view, he was the employee of Mr. Blair, but Mr. Blair was subcontracted to Mr. Jenkins. And so that's where perhaps my assessment of this and the court's, I may not be making it as clear as I hoped I would, that we've really got a daisy chain, to use an old fashioned term, where Mr. Jenkins was in the middle of this daisy chain. And that would mean that when it turns out that Mr. Blair ends up with an injured employee and he has no insurance, the place that the injured employee should look for a statutory employer is with Mr. Jenkins, not with Associated Aluminum Products.
But isn't that essentially a factual conclusion that you know, we would have to hold as a matter of law the commission was wrong in looking at these relationships and the, you know, for example, the fact that basically all Jenkins did was pick him up and he didn't sign his W-2 form or anything like that. I mean, these are all points that individually, you know, you can take or leave, I suppose, but in terms of our standard of review and determining whether the commission erred in finding a statutory employer relationship here, you know, are they plainly wrong? And it seems to me that you're arguing as if the commission should have sort of come to a different conclusion where there's a fair debate about this stuff, and you know, but of course we can only hold as a matter of law the commission was wrong.
Well, it seems to me, Your Honor, that at least as I understand question of statutory employee, it's a mixed question of law and fact. And so whether they got the right statutory employer would similarly
well,
be.
I misunderstood your argument. I thought you were not quibbling with the test that exists for what a statutory employer is. You were quibbling with the way the commission applied the test to the facts.
Yes, sir.
And my question was simply, well, then that makes it a factual determination. And the only issue for us under our standard of review is, are there facts that support the commission's conclusion, in this case, that your client was the statutory employer of the claimant?
Well, I suppose I'm respectfully disagreeing, perhaps, that the court has a broader authority to assess who the appropriate statutory employer is, not whether. And in fact, the we cite a case, the Uninsured Employers Fund versus Clark, and cite it at length, that goes through a reversal of the commission's holding on this almost exact fact pattern, as to where the liability lay.
Counsel, let me just ask this. Is it your position that the determination of whether somebody is an employer under the statute, that's a legal determination de novo, application of the facts to that, once you make that determination, is a factual determination that's reviewed under the appropriate discretion?
Yes, ma'am.
Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, ma'am. And so we would contend that the determination of which subcontractor or which statutory employer, in essence, is tagged is more of a mixed question of law and fact than just saying you get the commission with in an unfettered way gets to say this is the appropriate statutory employer. And in fact, the Clark case in fact looked at and went through very much, and this, the pattern was in Clark was the same. There was there was a contractor, there was a subcontractor by the interesting name of IRS, and then there was an additionally oddly named subcontractor of TLC. So I guess after you work for IRS, you need some TLC. I didn't quite understand where all of that came from.
It was pretty good.
It went right through the and it's in the piece of it that's significant is on page 24 of our brief. But what the deputy held as being a ruse between the relationship with Associated Aluminum and Mr. Blair, the Court of Appeals, looking at something very similar, said the dealings between the general contractor and TLC were a matter of effective and efficient communications, not contractual negotiations.
Counsel, the term that I keep going back to and usually don't see it in the context of workers' compensation law is privity of contract. And I remember that term from law school and have some knowledge as to how it works. And it seems to me that privity of contract would apply here because you have three people who are involved in the same contractual relationship looking for a mutual benefit. In other words, you got the contractor wants someone to provide work. Contractor doesn't have the workers' compensation insurance. Subcontractor can provide that, and then you have an employee who can actually do the work. So you have all parties aligned. So you have privity of contract for a mutual benefit. Doesn't that support the context or the conclusion that this is indeed fits within the category of work described in 65.2?
Well, it seems like to me, although I don't know that it was ever a major significant question, but that the Associated Aluminum had a workers' compensation policy. Jenkins had a workers' compensation policy, and Blair didn't have a workers' compensation policy. It wasn't a question of whether the evidence makes it unequivocally clear that Associated Aluminum was not intending to expose its workers' compensation policy to an injury. And so when Mr. Blair didn't have workers' compensation coverage, they, in essence, insisted he get it somewhere other than from them, and that other than them was Jenkins. And without taking the 53 seconds I've got left to really read through some of the parts of this Clark case, it's identical. And the court reversed the commission's view in this case and looked at the almost identical behavior between Associated Aluminum, the Jenkins is the middle link in the daisy chain, and Mr. Blair. And we would ask that the court reverse the case and dismiss Associated.
Thank you, Mr. Pretty.
Aluminum. Thank you.
Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Mike Del Bueno. I'm here on behalf of Ronnie Jenkins and Virginia Farm Bureau. So since that's the issue that we're dealing with on the statutory employer, I'll argue on behalf of those parties. May it please the court, Your Honors, first of all, from a procedural standpoint, okay, we've got a full commission, unanimous opinion. There's no dissent here. All right. And it was a factual finding, as Your Honors were pointing out before. All right. And the factual finding on this issue was basically this. You had APCO as the general contractor, who then subcontracted to Rodney Blair, who then hired the claimant, Mr. Elvira Menes. Okay? And the law on appeal here before Your Honors is this is a mixed question of law and fact. However, there were factual findings. And those factual findings are binding upon this court on appeal.
What is the question of law that you believe exists here that we have to analyze the facts from?
I don't think there is a legal issue. I think it's merely factual.
It's a mixed question of law. In fact, then we have to have some predicate for the law. So what is the predicate?
Somebody's a statutory employer.
Who's the statutory employer?
Yeah, who is it and why?
Okay, it's Rodney. It's APCO is the statutory employer. Okay, and the reason why is this. Who did APCO subcontract with? All right, APCO would have you believe that they subcontracted with Ronnie Jenkins, but that's not supported by the facts at all. Rodney Blair is the party that APCO subcontracted with without question. The lane job where Mr. Elvira Menes was injured, this was a roofing job. All right, Ronnie Jenkins had an employment application with APCO, and he did not list roofing as an area of work that he performed on that employment application. Ronnie Jenkins had a workers' compensation insurance policy through Virginia Farm Bureau, and what it covered was this, quote unquote, carpentry detached one or two family dwellings. Marvin Craven is a representative of APCO. Mr. Craven gave some testimony on this case, and he testified that he would not give Ronnie Jenkins a roofing job unless he had roofing workers' compensation insurance. And he was asked, okay, well, if this language was in Mr. Jenkins's workers' compensation insurance policy, specifically carpentry detached one or two family dwellings, do you consider that to cover roofing? And his answer was no. So APCO would have you believe that they subcontracted with somebody for a roofing job who didn't do roofing and didn't have roofing workers' compensation insurance. And that's ultimately where you come to the conclusion that this so-called agreement or arrangement was merely a ruse. And what it did was it allowed APCO to get the work done by Rodney Blair, who didn't have insurance. And that's what APCO wanted. They wanted Rodney Blair to do the work, and they had to figure out a way to make it work within their own policies of having somebody do work for them who had workers' compensation insurance policy. So
Counsel,
they brought in Ronnie Jenkins.
How do you square this with the Clark decision?
It's completely different. In Clark, the party that was ultimately found to be the statutory employer had a whole bunch of involvement in the work performed and also contracted with the parties in question. Here, you didn't have that. You had APCO dealing wholeheartedly on every aspect of the lane job with Rodney Blair. Ronnie Jenkins didn't have any involvement. Ronnie Jenkins wasn't present on the job site. Ronnie Jenkins didn't get involved with Rodney Blair's work. Ronnie Jenkins didn't get involved with Mr. Elvira Menes' work. He wasn't even there. He didn't control anybody. He didn't direct anybody. He didn't supervise anybody. So Clark, you had the holding as it did because that party that was ultimately found to be the statutory employer was involved in the work. Here, Ronnie Jenkins wasn't. So that's why Clark is completely different. He didn't even sign off on any contracts for the lane job. Okay, the Lane job contract is in evidence. Ronnie Jenkins didn't sign off on it. He didn't see it. He wasn't involved in it. He didn't have anything to do with it. So that's why it's different. No further questions.
All right.
Thank you,
Council. Mr. Pretty, you've used up all your time, but I will give you 1 minute if you want to respond to any of that. We asked you a lot of questions, and you chewed up a bit of your rebuttal time, so I'll give you 1 minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. I was sitting here just sort of enjoying this.
Well, you can continue to do that. You know, don't feel compelled to use it.
Sort of taking it all in, huh?
Yeah, like another opportunity.
All this ambiance we have here in this courtroom, yeah.
It's a beautiful day outside, here we are.
The one thing I would like to make a point about is Mr. Jenkins understandably wants to say, I wasn't there, I didn't do anything. I didn't, but I do want to make sure that I don't leave on the table the rule that this court has adopted and as has the Supreme Court of Virginia, that you look to the power to control, not the actual exercise of control. And so while Mr. Jenkins may not have been there, it wasn't as if Mr. Jenkins was unaware, and the evidence makes it clear he was aware, that he was getting a 10% cut of what was being paid to Mr. Blair. And he had the power to control, he just didn't exercise it.
All right, thank you, Mr. Pretty. We will, as our custom, we will come down and greet counsel and then take up Folly versus Common.